det møte vi har her i Oslo. Mitt navn er Petter Reinholdsen, og jeg er de som har skjedd her. Etter møtet så tusler vi opp til den greske restauranten Alexandros for å leske strupen og få gjøre maten. Alle er hjertelig velkommen dit. Og neste møte blir antagelig årsmøte i NU, for de som har løft om møte opp der. Temaet er ikke bestemt enda. Denne gangen har vi fått interessant tema som ikke er så ofte på programmet, og det programmeringsspråket er klart. Jeg har ikke så mye mer tilfører som jeg tror.
Yes, I chose to speak in English tonight, mostly because our language is not better than Norwegian, but if you have any questions and you want to ask in Norwegian, just go ahead. I understand Norwegian. My name is Vaslav Lopaki. I'm a system architect at Telenor. A year ago, and before that, I was a system architect for SGSM. That was known in GSM GPRS network made by Ericsson. Today I'm going to talk about Erlang and its use in the industry. This presentation is actually made based on another presentation that Urban Bluquist has made. It's my former colleague from Ericsson. And this is my former Christopher Nielsen. So exactly what I'm going to talk about today. First of all, I'm going to say a little bit about mobile networks, mobile telecommunications networks. About packet core network, where SGSM belongs, and then about using Erlang in SGSM. Then a little bit about principle, design principle in SGSM for Erlang, and a little bit about the different capabilities of Erlang, like concurrency, distribution, fault tolerance, overall protection, and runtime scope replacement. Finally, there will be a small example, some small basics and examples that you can maybe try out at home and start programming on Erlang. So they're very easy. So, mobile telecommunication networks and the GSM, you probably know a lot about GSM already. You use it every day. But when we look at the telecommunication networks and especially at GSM, then we can talk about two different domains. One is circuit switched and the other one packet switched. Circuit switched, that's basically the voice calls that you make. Also SMS can be classified as packet switched. That's basically packet-based traffic, and that is everything that is IP-based in mobile networks. That includes WAP, that includes the web traffic, email and MMS. Then that part of GSM network is also standardized as GPRS. And like your own UMTS, GPRS, the General Packet Radio Service, the standard that describes how to send the packets on the mobile network. And packet core network, what it is actually, if you look at the whole GSM network, this is the very simplified picture of how the GSM network might look like. It looks like on one side you have a radio network, you have your GSM phone, mobile station, or actually most correctly you could call it mobile terminal, because it could be a PDA or another device. And you have an antenna, or really just a transmitter, so-called BTS. We have another small network element here, BSC. On the other hand, we have on the other side we have a packet cop network, and that's where SGSN and GGSN belong. I'm sure SGSN and GGSN can connect to the internet. So I'm going to talk about SGSN as the first network element in the packet cop network in a GPRS network. As I said, we have two different kind of GPRS or the GSM nodes. One type says GSM serving GSM, and the other one is gateway GSM. And both of those nodes, they sort of are basic nodes in that network and the United. And they basically can transmit or as much as 150 kilobit per second with GPRS per subscriber, or 240 kilobit per second with Edge. This is, of course, the technology is a little bit old. Now we have a newer technology coming in, or actually already available here, like 3G and Turbo 3G. Those are based on a little bit different technology. It's not like GPRS. It's a third generation network based on technologies like WCDMA and HSDPA. Those are basically targets for the radio network. However, in the Ericsson implementation and in general, the SGS and the packet code network, GSM and GSM behind, they're exactly the same as in GPRS. There's almost no difference. Especially in Ericsson, it's exactly the same node. No matter if you use your GSM phone or your 3G phone, you will be routed through the same node. This is probably different compared to other vendors like Nokia, etc. They usually implement two different types of nodes. And those nodes, of course, techniques provide much higher speeds. And we are talking about 384 kilobits per second for 3G via WCDMA. And up to 14 megabits per second for HSDPA. If you follow a little bit news in Norway, especially in the telecom domain, you know that Telenor, for example, provides 1.8 megabit per second currently in some base stations, probably even more, double that. 3.6 megabit per second. In some time, in a few years, you probably will see much higher rates. And I just read that Telstra in Australia, they started looking with Ericsson into even higher speeds. We're talking about 42 megabits per second, so-called evolved HSPA. So we are really talking about serious bandwidth. After that, you have this long-term evolution, access methods, and there it's not really standardized, so no one knows how fast it will be, but we are talking about 100 megabits at least, or even more. So you can start questioning why do we need so much bandwidth just a mobile phone. I think there will be applications that will use actually when we come there. In 3G, the voice and video calls are still circuit switched. Streaming video is still packet switched. And we have also some sort of support for TV, it's called MDMS, Multimedia Broadcast Multicast Service. Unfortunately, I don't think it will be available in Norway, I haven't heard that. There's another technology that will be available here. In the future, voice and video also will be sent through the packet network. And of course, voice over IP, you know, after some time we'll probably see phones that use that access network. Actually, there are some already, some very early versions. Now, if you look at the main subject today, it's on the yes and no. This picture shows a little bit older, but it's basically that's how it looks. It's just one, two shells with boards, some 30 or 50 boards in there. During the years, SGSN was first launched in year 2000, and the first release was capable of around 50k subscribers. But now, every second year, the capacity was doubled, and now we are actually reaching 2 million subscribers. It's quite a lot. I mean, it's just all the subscribers in Norway in Telenor network in one single box. Now, I think this is because this growth was possible because of Adam. I can't see that other technologies would enable this sort of scalability. It was not only because of the hardware. Hardware contributed a little bit, but I think the power of Erwin made it possible. And why, it will come up later. When we look at what actually SGSN provides, we can distinguish between two different domains, two different layers. One is the control signaling, the other one is payload transport. Control signaling, there we have some basic services like authentication, admission control, quality of service, mobility, roaming. Those who know GSM and mobile networks know what we're talking about. Payload transport, that is the other domain, which is it's very simple. It's basically routing the traffic, routing the payload, the user traffic. The control signaling is complicated. It's lots of protocols, complex protocols. Payload transport is very simple. And this will be visible now in the actual architecture of SGSN, how actually do we implement it. Well, control plane, the complicated part, no one really attempts to make it real time. So here we're talking about soft real time. Soft real time means that we don't really have to meet the deadlines. It has to be more or less fast. I mean, you know, the answer has to come within a couple of 100 milliseconds. But there's no need for really a guarantee that it will come so fast. And in the control plane, we can actually use techniques, use languages like Erlang. In the payload plane, where it is very important that it's, we have to process the traffic very fast. I mean, you can't really afford any delays. There we are talking about hard real time. And then you have to use the proper techniques, proper language for that. So there's this dualism. It's both. On one side, where we need, where we have lots of complexity, and where we don't need this quick answer, we use soft real time. And on the payload plane, where we need actually that the system doesn't introduce too much delays and latency, there we have to use hard real time. And that's basically how the SGSN is designed. You have boards which are in control plane and another set of boards which run payload plane. Now we are actually into the hardware. Let's see. How much GSM is usually around 20 to 30 coprocessors boards? Those are running ultra spark or power PC CPUs. Currently with around 2 GB memory, running Solaris or Linux with Helm, and of course some C and C++. You have to add a little bit of those. You could run on the Helm, but sometimes it's a little simpler to implement some parts and see. In payload plan, we have 20 to 30 payload processors, payload boards. Those are running on PowerPC CPUs. And there's some special hardware like FPGAs for encryption. And those boards also have so-called physical devices like FrameLay, ATM, external Ethernet and so on. Because it's payload, so you have to put lots of cables into this slot, so much to put going through such a node. And then we are talking also about backplane, which is a network behind the boards, and there you have 1 gigabit between all of those boards. It's maybe not so much throughput in the backplane, 1 gigabit is not much for 30 or 60 boards to communicate through. But that is okay because we have those interfaces on the payload boards. Then when we get down to the details about actual signaling, what kind of signals NSGSM, the central part, is actually receiving, those are basically signals like attach. This is basically when you switch on the phone and it loads onto the GPRS network. But this on Ericsson, it would be this small triangle because we actually did an attach. That is basically when you move from one place to another and you go from so-called one routing area to another, and the system has to register that you are in another place of the network. And then you have activation, which is actually the initiation of the so-called PDP context. In other words, it's basically starting doing some payload, starting doing something useful when you browse the web page or web page, or even when you send an MMS, then the phone will do first activation towards the SGSM, etc. There are really a number of signals that SGSM has to handle. And if you look into the telecom standards, which describe those protocols, they are really huge. It's thousands of pages, so it's complex. You can't really implement that in C. You will die. So we made another language, which is easy to manage, which where you can really just concentrate on details of what you have to implement, not think about the language itself. Something that is easier than C, C++, which is easier than Java. And the answer is quite fast. Well, Helm is probably such a language. That's why those people have chosen that as for implementing the JSON. So what is Helm and what is OTP? I said a little bit about Helm. OTP is basically some sort of platform behind Helm. Helm was invented by Ericsson in some 1980s. It was from the beginning intended for reliable telecom systems. No surprise, Ericsson makes telecom systems, so they needed language to do what they need. But it proved to be much more than that. Basic capabilities or functionality, it's a functional language. It has nothing to do with object orientation, which is so very popular, or was very popular, you know. It's a totally different way of thinking. In addition, it has a very strong built-in support for concurrency, distribution, and fault, and OTP, that's Open Telecom Platform. It's basically Erlang plus lots of libraries for different things, telecom libraries, frameworks, etc. Why do we actually need Erlang? I already said a little bit about it, but just to sum it up a little bit. It has a built-in concurrency. Very easy to implement, the message passing is very simple. Built-in distribution, built-in fault tolerance. There's something called runtime code replacement, which is a very fancy feature actually, which SGSN has also used, apparently. Yes. In addition, it's a dynamic language, and a dynamically tagged language. And this is exactly what is needed to build a robust control plane in a telecom system. At the same time, which is not too complicated and not really, you know, without producing millions of lines of code, you have to be able to manage and maintain such system afterwards. One could maybe discuss why dynamically tagged language is such a good thing, because there are many opinions about that, but to be honest, it really shortens the code dramatically. And there are tools in Erlang to get around the problem that it is dynamically typed, that you don't know what types you actually send around. There are tools to detect that will make errors. In SGSN itself, Erlang is using control plane, where it is there's no problem to the time constraints, or at least not really so much. It doesn't matter if the system answers within a 5 milliseconds instead of 2 milliseconds. Right? And then in the user plane, actually, the GSM uses C, which is much better for time-critical systems. And when we get to some details about the concurrency, I'm not sure if you you probably know this stuff from before from other languages like Java or C. Nothing what you saw before looks the same in Erlang. In Erlang, you don't really have any semaphores or monitors, doesn't exist. Everything is done with processes and message passing. And actually, that simplifies the problem a lot. I was struck by the first time I started programming in Erlang, and I was a little bit. I had a lot of respect for programming distributed systems. It was so complicated, and so especially my school programming with modular or some other, and it just wasn't always so very easy. But when it came to Erlang, actually, I made a concurrent program, distributed program, and I didn't realize it was what, because it's so easy, you actually don't realize that you deal with these problems. We have, of course, things like mutual exclusion, and that is made in Erlang, that is realized in Erlang, using just a single process. A single process handles the resources and guards them. So you get the message gets processed, and this, if someone else wants to get hold of this resource, it will have to get another, it will be the next message in the queue. So we will not release the resource until we have finished processing the message. So it's extremely simple. And of course, critical sections, the same. You have one process guarding the piece of code. So it's always only one execution at a time, and the other ones have to wait. Sounds a little bit restrictive maybe, but it's very efficient actually. And it's problems with deadlocks. I haven't really explained so much, you know. If you think about Java, how do you actually implement concurrency? How do you implement those issues there? It's really complex. It's another language. You learn normal Java programming, and then you have to learn concurrent Java, right? It's a totally different world. In our language, it's the same thing. It's building. Then the distribution. Erlang is very good in distributing things, but of course distribution costs. So in SGSM, they made actually a rule that the remote communication has to be avoided as much as possible, because if you can avoid it, then your throughput will raise a lot. So number of hops between different boards has to be limited to the minimum. And in most of the cases, just you get into SGSM, you are held by one board and routed outside. So there are actually no hops between boards at all. And if you think about Java implementation, there is basically probably talking about hops all the time, because every time you want to call something else using IMI, you have to look up the resource and then call that thing. Usually it's the same board, but it doesn't have to be. Therefore, in SGSM we concentrated on making algorithms which will make it possible to work independently. And that is both for the performance, load balancing, and also fault tolerance. It's very important in those large systems that you don't make some support that will suddenly take down the whole node. You have to somehow encapsulate the problem into as small processes, as small piece of code as possible. So try to just restart one process, try to restart just one board. Don't take down the whole node, it's a lot of subscribers. Another thing is that they decided to avoid relying on global resources. So there's no single process in node that would give you some identity or this kind of support. It's quite normal in distributed systems. But instead, it's important to make an algorithm that actually, instead of going asking some process somewhere on another board, give me an ID, well, you just slice the ID range into slices that will fit each board and then allocate the ID locally. So this kind of technique that you use to avoid the communication as much as possible. And the same about data handling. It's important that you don't distribute data in the node. You should try to keep it locally as much as possible. Some data has to be, of course, duplicated, because if one board goes down, then you would like to continue the service, right, on another board. So you need this kind of support, but it's really limited to the absolute minimum. And about fault tolerance. The requirements on SGSM is that it has to be in service 99.5 nines, basically. It's a really tough requirement. It's just a couple of minutes during the year that you're allowed to have the system down. Most of you know that 5 nines is a well-known term. It's the top availability. So there's lots of automatic support 40 volts are taken out automatically. Mobile phones that are on that board will be automatically redistributed to other boards. There's also a lot of software fault tolerance. An important principle is that software error that is triggered somewhere by one phone shouldn't actually affect other phones. We should try to just restart that single process and continue. Don't bother about it, but try to handle the rest. But the serious problems, which are not caused by just one single phone, but more in the system itself, they have to be handled at some high level. But as I said earlier, you should try to take at most one board, not more. So an example of how wrong it can get. You have some software handling one phone. The software on the phone gets crazy and sends some corrupted messages to the GSM. And of course, no one thought about it. They tried to protect it as much as possible. No one thought about getting this kind of message. The only thing that will happen is that that single process will crash. You will get the crash report that can be analyzed immediately after it happened. But the node itself, it continues running. It can generate hundreds, thousands of those crashes in an hour, and still continues working. So you have time to actually analyze the problem, make a fix it. The problem actually might be not in your node, it might be somewhere in some Samsung node or somewhere in another phone. Something that you are not able to fix at all. You will have to patch it and make it work around. A little bit about architecture of the control plane. I said quite a lot about it. But we have those small processes for each subscriber. So if you look at those control plane boards, each control plane actually has some around 100 processes which provide those important system services. And those are called static workers. It's not OTP. It's not error and term, it's something that actually is invented in Ericsson. On each subboard, we have also around 50,000 subscribers, or really 50,000 processes running. Each process handles one phone. Then, if you know Unix, if you know Java, can you tell me how many processes can you run there on one board? Just a guess. Yeah, you probably won't be able to run more than a couple of thousands. I doubt. This is a very important feature in Elm. It has some so-called light process support. So one process will not correspond to one Unix process, but it will be some sort of embedded process in Elm itself. This basically means it's very light, it's very small. So actually, someone did an experiment somewhere on a normal PC with some 4 GB or 2 GB memory, I don't know exactly. It managed actually to run over 1 million of processes. You can dream about it in other languages. In Java, every single process will correspond to a Unix thread, and then you run out very quickly out of resources. So this is something that makes it so much easier to actually implement the logic behind, because you can just concentrate on that single process, just implement what it needs to do, right? You don't have to bother about all this stuff about sharing the same process space, the same data, and so on, as you have to do in J2E, for example. You don't have to think all those problems. If something, if your backend system doesn't respond, and everything just hangs, what will happen in Java world, in a normal application server, would be, yeah, suddenly you run out of threads, right? You can't do anything. There, the only thing will happen is that you will have those processes that will hang on the backend, but still, the system is able to spawn new processes and handle the request, continue to do that. And only memory is the limit. It basically means that it's much more robust. You can do much more with this kind of system. And spawning process is very, very simple and very easy compared to other methods. It's very fast. Yeah, those dynamic work, those spawned small processes. So as I mentioned already, one LM process comes as all signaling from a single mobile phone. And when you receive a signal from a payload board, it first comes there and then comes to the control plane, and then it will translate into some LM message. So that single process will basically implement some sort of state machine. We'll receive a signal, do some computation, send a reply. It looks a little bit like an entity being injured in J2E, right? It has some state, it has some support for transactions as well and this kind of stuff. But you know how the story of entity beings has ended in Java, right? It never worked out. But actually in Erlang it's possible and it works. And that's what we use the most. So this feature is probably one of the most important parts of it, that you can implement a simple state machine, implement it in a single process, and make it very, really, very nice implementation of the protocol without really worrying about if your transaction for that mobile is completed or not. You don't have to worry about that. You just let the process wait for it. When the answer comes, then you continue. And another consequence of that, of having just those small processes, is that whenever it actually crashes, what happens? Well, you just affected one mobile, you just affected a small amount of your functionality. The memory is protected, so you will not corrupt memory for other processes. It doesn't happen. So it will be basically, if something wrong goes with a single phone, it will just a short service outage for that phone, no one else. And that's 1 out of 2 million, right? It's almost no problem. And as I said, what you do is you generate a crash report. So you have all the information that you need to know what actually happened. You don't need some extra logging and debugging stuff to actually figure out what went wrong. You simply crash whenever something wrong, unexpected happens. And this is a concept called offensive program that you see mentioned here. You know that this defensive programming, you know what defensive programming is about. Offensive programming is just the opposite. Defensive programming is about, you have to always protect your code against all possible cases when it can go wrong. And you have to, before you start implementing, you have to actually know exactly what kind of error cases might happen, and every single problem that can happen, you have to try to foresee. Offensive programming is the opposite, and there is a okay, let's concentrate on what's important. This is the main function that we have to implement. We implement that. Maybe some very obvious error cases, but we don't try to think about absolutely everything. This comes later when we use the system. Obviously, this results in much less code, right? Which you don't try to figure out all possible what can go wrong. You just do what is actually needed. And how actually, what actually happens when such a worker crashes? Well, all the workers in Ireland, they have a so-called supervisor. It's a process that will handle those error cases whenever a worker crashes. Then the supervisor will be notified. And it will, depending on what happens with the worker, it will trigger a recovery action. I'm not very specific now, but I mean, the rules behind how to react to each crash are really so, you can make it so complicated that, well, to make it a little bit short, when the worker crashes for the first time, you just restart, right? If it crashes for 3 times, you know that something, within a couple of minutes, you know something else is wrong. And you have to escalate, and you have to take down more processes. And escalate and escalate. In the end, you have to take down the whole board. But later on, if that doesn't help, you know yourself. You have to restart the whole mode. If that doesn't help, so there's not much that can help. You have to call support. Runtime code replacements, as I said, it's a very interesting feature. What is this about, actually? I'm not sure if you realize. Basically, it means that you are able to install your corrections without stopping the system, stopping the process itself. So it automatically starts running new code, of course, when you tell it to. And Erlang can actually load a new version of module in the running system. However, you have to be careful because, I mean, usually when you change the code, you affect the data on the process, right? So when you switch from one version to another, obviously you have different structure. So you have to handle the switch over. So this is the complicated part. In swapping the code. But it's possible to do, and actually it's implemented in SGSN as well with some limitations that you should be careful when you change the data structures. But without the changing data structures, it's okay. You just load it and it's there. And I haven't heard about that in J2E. And actually, seen that many places. Overall protection is also a feature that was necessary to implement the SGSM on top of those this L1 and OTP support. It's a typical sort of functionality that you need in those large nodes. You have to have some way of saying limiting the traffic on the CPU or when the memory is used. So the idea basically behind is that instead of just getting saturated and getting the system totally overloaded and stop answering anything, well, you have to put some sort of different prioritizations on different messages, and you basically start dropping certain messages. First, those not important, then those more important in the end, hopefully, you are still having the most important messages. If you don't have those, then you have a problem. But this usually stops somewhere on those a little bit more important messages. And you have two choices, actually. You could drop the message, of course, no, that is not so good. Or you could simply reply that, no, we are overloaded, we cannot handle the traffic now. Now, it's basically all about SGS in itself. Now we will get a little bit to more practical part of the presentation. And I'm going to show a little bit about how everything looks like. I understand that none of you tried Erlang or all right? Or did anyone of you tried Erlang? Okay, you. It might be boring for you, but I think for the rest it would be interesting. Erlang is basically available on all sorts of systems, operating systems, starting with Linux, Unix, Solaris, etc. It's even available for Windows. I'm not going to show that. In order to start Erlang, just type L. Of course, you have to install it first. Well, you have to go through those installation manuals and so on. But it's really, really simple compared to many other languages I tried to install. Actually, I haven't found any Linux system that wouldn't be able to compile and install Erlang. If you get into trouble, just let me know. It would be a new experience. So, what do you do with Erlang? Well, you could make a small file with a piece of code. We call it a module, right? Make a function, and here's an example. In some file called .l, you would type a module name, mymod, and then say that we want to export a function. A double, and this one means that there's only one parameter. Then double, it's not a very complicated function, just doubles whatever you put in. And if you want to call her from another place, from another module, and you do it like that. You can do it with any function which is exported, I guess. And you have another concept which is quite specific for Erlang, and that's atoms. Atoms are basically some sort of piece of tags. I'm not sure how to call it. It's basically an atom. It's sort of a name that you can pass around in the system, and it has a meaning to everybody once it is defined, and everybody knows what the form is the form. And you could actually make some more complicated structures, and in Erlang we call them tuples. Those look like more or less like records, but there's another structure for records as well. But the tuple is basically just a combination of few tuples, you can put several items into it. It could be integer, it could be another atom, it could be another tuple. It's just a way of embedding this structure, data structure, without actually defining a record. And you could put those data records or data structures into some list. And here we have a list, which is a list of both of tuples and integers. We can define variables like this. Here's a tuple and another variable, which is a list. And then if you want to actually concatenate the list, you just simply do like this. This is one list, this is another list. So concatenation is very, very simple in writing to output. That's not a very basic thing. You need to know hello world. Typical example. One thing about variables, you can only define them once. So once you have defined a variable A, you can define it again in the same function, in the same block. This is quite special. So in Erlang, usually quite often you see A and A1, A2, A3, and so on. Someone changes the content for the variable, and then you have to allocate a new variable for it. Another simple syntax, it's a case and functional case close and functional close. Case you use quite a lot, of course, you know that from other languages. Here we have actually a case, a so-called pattern matching. Pattern matching is very special for Erlang as well. Case you recognize, it's nothing special. But then this var could be a tuple, right? And here, using this kind of pattern, you specify which case actually to choose. Those underscores means that you accept everything. But those two last fields have to be specific. Or actually, in this case, this is a variable which will be assigned a value of last element of this tuple. So simply, this tuple has to have a third element cut. This one has a third element equal to holds. And here's a last case which accepts everything, and then we'll just see print of no entrance. The same you could actually implement using so-called function close, which is much faster way, or much more compressed way of actually implementing this kind of case-like structures. So you, instead of writing a case, you just make a function which has this pattern pattern as an argument. Right? Then Erlang will call write function for you. You see, it's much more compact. Right? Maybe show how it works. It's not very complicated, but here is this piece of code. I made a module called hello arrow in the top. You see a module hello, export function hello one, and here we have the implementation. By the way, this is Eclipse, as you noticed, and there's actually fortunately there's some support for Eclipse. It's called Erleader. If you want to download and install Erlang, you probably will appreciate that. It helps a lot, as in other languages. Now, actually, Erleader has compiled this for me already. I have another shell here with compiled. With compiled code. So we got this hello bean produced here. But you see also error on crash down. Something wrong has happened here. It was before it was something. So now I will start Erlang. It's very simple, right? I will load the module. I don't have to do that, but if I do that, then I can really type the module name, and then I will get the help with what functions you have in the module. So just type hello with the parameter which will trigger the first case here, right? So what you got while is this is printout. There's also return value here. Because we return X, we return the variable. But we got as a last element of the value. Very simple example. What happens if I type something that is not a tuple? Well, no entrance. You could put M in here. The value is the same. As you said, it's another thing. Erlang is not type language, so the term here, it could be anything. It can be a string, can be integer, tuple, list, whatever. It doesn't crash, it doesn't, it just passes around. So it's quite convenient in many cases. Right.
How do you know that X is not atom?
How do I know if X is not atom?
Yeah, you say it's a variable.
It could be an atom, I can put an atom in it.
I think it's an uppercase letter.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, the difference between variables and atoms is the first letter. So atoms have limited namespace. It cannot start with digits, it cannot start with uppercase, etc. Those are really the case. Another simple example is recursion. Well, in Erlang you don't have any loops. That's another thing that will strike you. How do I get around without loops? Well, you actually can, you just use recursion. And it's actually pretty efficient in Erlang. Here we have two different implementations of a factorial function, you know what the factorial is. So simple stuff. The first implementation is a simple one, the simplest you can come up with. So with argument 0, it will return 1. Yeah. That's obvious. With other argument, you would recursively call the other the same function until you reach 0. Right. Then, it's not very complicated, but actually run an example on that. So that's how it looks like. I can, you know, here and the module name was fucked. And then let's put a 0. Okay, it's 1. Let's put 10. And so on. It's not very slow, right? This is very simple. But now, this is not really very efficient because every time you make a loop here, you call this recursive function, you have to actually leave something, you have to leave the result on the stack and heap. So you use lots of memory and you have to allocate the memory, deallocate the memory. That takes all the resources. That's why we make another version of it, which is called so-called type recursive. And the only difference here is that we actually just pass the result around whenever we call recursively. We pass it to another loop. And this version doesn't consume any memory. And it's much faster as well. And usually you make this kind of proper here to avoid having two parameters, because otherwise you have to always put this one parameter. A little bit more advanced syntax, some dynamic code. We have some dynamic support in Erlang, and that's called FAN. It's really FAN, actually. So how do you implement the FAN? Well, just take a variable, and you assign to it something that starts with fun and then your argument and the familiar piece of code. Actually, to end the fun with end. Then when you want to call that fun, well, you just do it like that. You could actually pass the fun to the damn code to another function and let it do something else. And here we have an example of a function that will, for each element of this list, it will call a fun. So simply just, as you see here, it will just run this function over all elements.
another more complex thing is message passing. So this is all you need to pass and receive message. It doesn't matter if it is on the same machine, same node, or another node. It looks pretty much the same. And I can actually show how it works. Here I will start, I have two shells now, and I will start two different LR nodes. Trying on the same machine, but it doesn't really matter where I could run remotely. The only thing I have to remember, I have to give a name to that node, and you do it using this S name. And when you say that I got an N2 at localhost name for this node, they can communicate with each other. And the other one will be N1. So we have two different nodes running. Now, to make it a little bit simpler, in the example there you saw it was a PID. A PID is a sort of process ID, it's quite a complicated structure. Usually, when we communicate between processes that are known to each other, we do so-called registration, which is a register process. We make a name which will be known within a whole LR node. I can register now. Just now the shell process, self, right? Self is our process, our shell process, as process P1. And start waiting for a message. All I do here is just try to receive something and just return it. Now we will try to send a message from another node. Right? So we'll type the name of the process to the movie receiver. And then I have to type on which node it actually resides. Because that process is only registered locally, it's about. So this is the process we call right on another node. And this explanation is actually the message passing syntax. And let me just put some message here. Make it a little bit more complicated. This is an empty list. So we just send the same message between two different nodes. Those nodes can be registered so-called globally, and then you could simply pass it to a P1 process instead. You don't have to know where it is actually registered. In OTP, we actually have a little bit more advanced implementation of this message sending support. It's called GenZapper. There you just use this call function to send the message around. And call is actually synchronous, so you would send the message one way and then wait for a reply, send it back, and the caller will be suspended when you do it. The receiver just has to implement this sort of hand call. You send a message, and then you send a reply using this sort of token. Reply means that you send an asynchronous reply, and this is the actual result that will be sent. In SJSON, they actually implemented yet more advanced support for this, which has a little bit more a little bit better real-time characteristics. It doesn't hang so much and it has much shorter time out and stuff. So that's basically
all I want to say about Erlang programming itself. Now, Erlang is a functional language. How about it? Functional programming in general, I think, is quite good because the program is designed, they don't have to really think about all those details related to the programming language. You have also lots of this framework code in OTP with abstractions that help you out. Again, Server was one example of it. But you have also other frameworks for implementing supervision support and for state machines as well. Erlang is some sort of actually a DSL, which is domain-specific language, primarily implemented for telecommunications, but actually now it's becoming broader and broader. I'm not sure if you know about Gigabird. That's one of the most stable XMPP Jabber servers. It's available for it's open source. Or it's available for free. So functional language, functional programming is very good for this kind of problems. But is it actually the most important part of Erlang? I'm not sure. I think it's both functional that is functional language, but also all the other features, like that it is that has so much support for distribution, that has support for concurrency, fault tolerance. All those things make it actually so attractive. It's not only functional programming. There are many other functional programming languages available, but not many of them actually got to be used so much in practice as Erlang. Yeah. To conclude, well, you see that Erlang works very well for GPRS traffic control handling. But it is high-level language, obviously. You just consider it on important parts. It has the right capabilities and that is fault tolerance, distribution, etc. On the other hand, it's very hard to find good Erlang programmers. There are no Erlang programmers in Norway, as far as I know. Some of them in Sweden, but it's also hard to find them there. Erlang OTP is not yet a mainstream language, and that means that we don't have all those tools, not so many tools, both for implementing programming environments. You don't have that. Well, you have Eclipse and Erlida, and that's about it. And then it's a single implementation, and it's basically still maintained by Ericsson. It's no one, it's not, it's open source, but it's not really open source. It's just one company that maintains and puts new functionality into it. But I hope this situation will change in a couple of years. And this, as I said, high level language, and with such language, it's really very easy to make real mess just in a few lines of code, as you can imagine. It's very, sometimes quite difficult to figure out what actually happened. If you want to learn more about Erlang, I invite you to the Erlang site, erlang.org. There is Erlang User Conference, and you don't have to be actually an expert to go there, because there's such a variation of subjects there. You can just, well, program for a couple of months, you go there. It's really interesting. It shows a little bit different areas where people use Erlang. You have the Erlang community, trapexit.org, and you have Erlang group on LinkedIn, which is actually, wasn't you, Michael, that you actually started?
Me and Martin Logan.
Yeah. Exactly. That's how I heard about Moon. So you are invited. There are a few books that you can read. The programming Erlang, this one is
This is the new one, the newest book.
I haven't actually read it, but I heard many opinions about it, and it's really good, according to some people. Concurrent programming in Erlang, this is an old book, over 10 years old now, but it's pretty good as well. It's actually, you can actually download parts of it from directly from Erlang on the Tor. You can start reading today. Plus, the documentation at Erlang.org is pretty good. They made lots of improvements lately. So that's about it. If you have any questions, so I can try to answer them.
Yeah. Not really a question, but I'm organizing a study group studying the latest Erlang book, and you can find the site for it at origo.no. Just search for Erlang.
It's erlang.origo.no.
Right.
Oh, is it?
erlang.origo.no.
Okay. That's good. It's good to see Erlang fans moving.
Questions?
I'm curious, if I may. Is there an you're working with Erlang in Norway, or are you working with different things in Norway?
No, I actually work with J2E. Sorry, there is no Erlang business in Norway. Let's forget it. I haven't heard about that. But I heard that there's one company actually called Creditor. They're running some service in Sweden. It's basically how they convert net banking into the paper-based invoice. Implemented this kind of support, and it's actually implemented purely in Erlang. And they have quite many people already in Stockholm, and they tried to actually move to or start business in Norway as well. So at some point, probably there will be some more companies and more business. And recently Erlang experienced quite a lot of interest on all the conferences. If you look at QCon, the coming QCon conference in London, there will be one speech on Erlang there. There was another one at JAL in Denmark last year, made by this guy that Joe Armstrong, which is actually the guy behind the Erlang. I was only working at Ericsson. That's where I started with Erlang, and that's where I end with Erlang. And now it's more or less a free time activity. More questions?
Then I say thank you very much.
Thank you.
It is the new logo in glass. There you are. You want to say it?
Yes, of course. Yeah, thank you very much for coming. Do you want to say something more?
No, I think we are done now.
Okay.
So we'll just head over to the Alexandros restaurant just up the street.